February 12, 2007 meeting of the House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development. Our first order of business this morning is the introduction of the committee members, and we will be presenting you your 2007 lineup for our committee. Generally, the chairman would go last, but to give perhaps the other committee members an opportunity to think about some of these things. I didn't want to spring this on them, but I'm going to ask each of the members to give their names, the district that they represent, and also to describe that district so that folks who may be listening in over the internet have some feel for where our committee members are from. If you would like, I think the public would be interested in why you, as an individual representative, feels that economic and workforce development is important to you and or your district. And lastly, if you feel comfortable, maybe we could share with the public some of our favorite pastimes so that we make this process feel to the public that we're a little more approachable. To begin with, I'm Brad Witt, and I'm the House member from District 31. My district runs from Sauvy Island, which is just north of Portland, on out to Astoria. The southern boundary of which runs, of course, right along the Columbia River. The southern boundary of my district zigs and zags out through the Coast Range. I represent a lot of trees and mountains in that portion, and my southernmost community is Vernonia. I think that workforce and economic development is exceedingly important to our state because I think that our committee will have an opportunity to help set in motion a robust future for not only our state's economy, but also for our state's workforce and an ability to hopefully make sure that everyone is able to participate in the bounty of a robust economy. Secondly, my district has on tap either actual or prospective $8 billion worth of economic development just a mere half dozen years ago. That kind of economic development was unimaginable in my district, and I think that we've been very fortunate to have some very good things come together, and I know there are some other very good things that the members of this committee have going on in their districts, and look forward to being able to share some of those things with the rest of the state. And lastly, some of my favorite pastimes include hunting and fishing and whiling away the hours on my farm in Klatskanai when I get the opportunity. With that, I'd like Vice Chair Riley to please introduce himself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Representative Chuck Riley, and my district is House District 29. Much easier to describe than the chairs. It's Cornelius, Forest Grove, and a big chunk of Hillsborough. And I'm lucky to be from a county that is the economic driver of the state, and I think it's very important for us to make sure that the rest of the state has an opportunity to share in that economic development, and I believe that we can do some good work here. My hobbies and what I like to do, I like to fly fish. That's one of the things I really enjoy. Being out on the river is probably, well, not on a cold day like today, but but otherwise it's one of the things I really enjoy. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for this opportunity.
Thank you, Vice Chair Riley. So the public knows Representative John Lim is our other vice chair, And he has the honor today of receiving a national award from the South Korean government for his assistance in facilitating a trade between South Korea and the United States. So when he returns next week, we will give him an opportunity to introduce himself. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Phil Barnhart. I represent House District 11. District 11 is an interesting district. It's really a microcosm of the state of Oregon. I have three precincts from South Eugene, east-southeast Eugene, but most of the district is small cities, Creswell, Brownsville, Coburg, and tree lots, farms, and at least some manufacturing. We were one of the centers for the manufacture of RVs in the United States in Coburg. Also in my district are a chunk of the University of Oregon. I get a piece of it. Representative Holvey in District 8 also gets a piece of it. And the main campus for Lane Community College is in my district. So it's natural that I'd be interested in workforce and economic development issues, because one of the key components of economic development, of course, is that the workforce is ready to participate in the economy. The workers are trained, have the knowledge that they need, and are ready to participate. As you said, Mr. Chair, we want everyone in Oregon to be able to participate in the economy, and that means the kind of things that we'll be working on are crucially important. You need capital, you need raw materials, you need transportation, and you have to have people who know how to put these things together in a way that makes the economy work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Representative Dolan.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I represent House District 59. It is about one-sixth of the land surface of Oregon. I start at Mosier and go to Arlington and then down to about Kimberly, over to Long Creek, into Granite, down the highway back to John Day, to Seneca. From Seneca back up to the highway and over to Black Butte Ranch, and from Black Butte Ranch up to Mosier again. It's huge. I can go 205 miles from my home to get to John Day, 260 to get to Granite, and 240 to get to Seneca. So I don't walk my district like the rest of you do. It's a far-flung enterprise. I have six counties basically in the district: Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, Grant, Jefferson. And then I have a part of Deschutes because the Crooked River Ranch is over to into Deschutes a bit. Then I have Marion and Clackamas County, but that's because the Warm Springs Reservation creates the boundary of my district, and it was done in 1855, predicated on a point from here to there. I don't have any people in Clackamas and Marion, but I'm in the voting pamphlet, and I like to get up there. There's a beautiful lake in Clackamas County where absolutely no one goes, and I go up there and campaign as regularly as I can. It is a beautiful district. Economic development is just as my district is a far-flung enterprise. Economic development in my district is huge. In fact, on this committee last session, 2 years ago at this time, one of the committee members called me gloom and doom. Things were not really bright in House District 59. The boom that was just starting, we were all coming out of some tough times, looked like it was going to jump over us. But since that time, Google has located in the Dalles, and that has been a real boon for Wasco County. And it's not as much, and it certainly is the people and the jobs, and we appreciate, but it's the attitude, the excitement. When you go to the stoplight, there's cars there now. And we got a new stoplight. But there's an ambiance of bubbling. Also, out of the last session, we cited the prison, and I'm pleased to say I worked very hard on that in Madras. Madras already had a little sparkle to it. But those are the two high points in my district. Other than that, we're primarily natural resources, tree fruit, wheat, cattle, and timber. And this committee has offered me an opportunity to sit with John Lim, Representative Lim, and formerly Senator Lim, and work on getting some of those natural resources out of our state and elsewhere. I think this committee might be, when times are good, we don't seem to be so important. But when times are bad, this may be the most important committee in the House. And for that reason, I really, and my district needs a boost. As there are certain pockets of Oregon that haven't participated in the mini boom we're in now. And I think it's our job to bring the whole state along. And as I look down the dais, all of us are shaking yes. So that gives us an opportunity to grow all of Oregon. Personally, my wife Dorothy and I spent a lot of time together. In fact, the only thing I didn't like about the last session is my wife was home and I was here, and so I brought her to the session. She's my legislative assistant, and she's actually drowning right now in the work that it takes. If I don't have some help by Tuesday, I may need a new one. I also have four children, and that is my hobby. I have four children and five grandchildren. We went fishing just out of Albany this summer a couple of times. And when you have a 4.5-year-old and a 2-year-old fishing, it is absolutely delightful. We made a water slide. I'm 62 years old. We had a 75-foot water slide, and Grandpa went down it with all five grandkids. And those sorts of things are what I really enjoy. And thank you for the opportunity to share what nobody really wanted to hear. The picture of me on a water slide is not pretty. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Dahlman. And I suspect your district's probably bigger than probably several of our states here in the country.
Yes, if I were on the Eastern Seaboard, I'd go across three states to go in some places in my district.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Fred Girard. I represent District 17. It was Jeff Krupp's old district. It basically, if you think about the Santiam River, if you know where that is, I have both forks of the Santiam, the north and the south. So the cities I have are such cities, big cities as Sublimity, Staten, Mahama, Lyons, Idana, Detroit, Mill City, Sweet Home, and Lebanon. I happen to be born and raised in the district. My father had a business there. My parents were involved in what was called then, excuse the language, but the dam days when the Detroit Dam was built. And so my family goes back there a long ways. I feel very honored to be here and grateful for that. Economic development for me, I was here once in 93. We fall under the three basin rule on the North Santiam River, which means that's a pristine river and we are the water supply for the city of Salem, but it puts a lot of restrictions on infrastructure. And in 93 we were able to get an agreement so that the city of Staten had a subsidized sewer so that they wouldn't impact on the city of Salem. And that was instrumental in allowing growth out in that area and the development of land. I also have a lot of timber industry in my district. Fact is, that's one of probably the primary industry outside of that and farming. And we've been hard hit, Representative Dowland's district, with the slowdown in the timber industry in a lot of different areas. And economic development is one of the ways that I see a way out for some of the communities that aren't quite doing as well as what I think they should be doing. For hobbies, I'm one of those people that really, really enjoy life in general. I love to fish. I love to travel. I just got back from watching the Beavers. I'm an avid Beaver fan. I went to the Sun Bowl, and I think I have frostbite on the derriere because it's so darn cold down there. Went to Carlsbad, saw the cavern. So I spent a fair amount of time. I'm fortunate enough that I'm able to travel, and I just love to travel. I love to fish, all kinds of fish. And I really look forward to being on this committee, and I think we're in with a bunch of really good legislators, and this is going to be a fun committee for me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Girard. Representative Holdy, save the best for last.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Paul Holdy, and I represent District 8, which is South Eugene, mostly. Take in most of the University of Oregon campus and downtown Eugene. And to many people's amazement, I also represent some more rural areas. The area goes west and takes in Fern Ridge Reservoir, the city of Veneta, and goes out to Notai and takes in some areas where we have quite a bit of forestry. Out in Alma in the Coast Range and goes south to the Douglas County line. Also takes in the Lorain Valley, which is a real up-and-coming wine area. We have many vineyards, no less than 7 wineries in my district. I also take in Crow. It's a smaller town where there is a little bit of farming and ranching around that area as well. We have within my district, we have a chip manufacturer, Hynix. We have many businesses in downtown Eugene, just a huge array of businesses in downtown Eugene. A little bit of microbrew business as well. And I'm really blessed to have a district that has worked very hard at diversifying its economy. We have been largely based on the forestry industry and still have a bit of that industry in the area. But we also have diversified into some other areas, and the University of Oregon has become very important as I reiterate that we train a workforce and are educating people, which we really need to compete. We have a huge shortage across the region, perhaps the nation, of a shortage of skilled workers. And the University of Oregon is in right in there looking to the future. We have a lot of nanoscience, and we're working on a lot of R&D exchange issues. I'm also a delegate from this body to the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, which is cooperating with states and provinces in Western Canada and Alaska and looking at our overall economy and how we really have a lot of issues that we share. So we work together on policy to help create some solutions to those issues and promote a workforce and economy that really helps the whole region, because we do not, our economy does not stop at the border, and our workforce does not stop at the border. So I'm very excited to be on this committee and hope that we can work to provide more jobs, better paying jobs for Oregon. I think that's really the real driver of our economy is having people being able to make good wages so they have money to spend in their communities. Thank you.
Committee members, thank you all very, very much. Next, I'm going to ask our staff to introduce themselves, and I'd just like to comment that our committee is exceptionally fortunate to have both our administrator and our assistant, and I think you'll find that we have a couple of what was referred to me as a first-round draft pick in terms of Ms. Osinek, who is our committee administrator. She is, in fact, in real life, assistant DA for Multnomah County. And Ellen, if you would please take a few minutes to share a little bit of your background with us and introduce yourself.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. My name's Ellen Osinek, and As Chair Witt has explained, I am a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, so that makes me attorney, and I hope that you all won't hold that against me. I'm really excited to be working with you all as your administrator. Just a little bit about me personally, along with my spouse, I'm an avid canoeist, and as I heard you all talking about your districts, I realize that I have paddled through many of your districts and really enjoy being on Oregon's rivers and just appreciate the opportunity to work with you all on this committee.
Thank you very much. And our committee assistant, who has been busy with Ms. Osinak and myself in helping to design the next couple of weeks for our committee, is Barry Kessinger. Barry, would you take a moment to introduce yourself, please?
Hello, everybody. I'm Barry Kessinger. I'm a member of the Association of Boxing Commission with some little bit of information for you. And this is my first legislative session. And I'm looking forward to enjoying the company and sharing with all these folks.
Thank you very, very much. Members of the committee, you had emailed, was it, to each of our members or passed out in one fashion or another anyways, delivered to your office, a set of proposed committee rules. We had asked if anyone had any recommendations for additions, deletions, or otherwise modifications. Didn't hear back from anyone. We will have an opportunity here to make any amendments should anyone so choose here in a minute, but I'm going to ask our committee administrator if she would please read those rules into the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are the proposed committee rules for the 74th Legislative Assembly. The committee will operate in accordance with the Oregon Constitution, House Rules, Mason's Manual of Legislative Procedure, and applicable statutory provisions. 1. Committee rules may be amended by affirmative vote of the majority of the committee, but at least one day's notice shall be given in writing to each committee member. 2. A quorum shall be comprised of a majority of the members appointed to the committee. In the absence of a quorum, the chair may assign fewer members to receive public testimony. A quorum for such hearings shall be one member. 3. The chair shall call committee meetings, set agendas, and cause notice of the time and place of committee meetings. 4. The speaker may designate subcommittees as deemed necessary and shall appoint the chair of each subcommittee. The chair of the full committee shall appoint the other members of the subcommittees. At the chair's discretion, measures may be either assigned to a subcommittee or retained in full committee for action. The chair at any time may remove a measure from a subcommittee and assign it to another subcommittee or the full committee. 5. The chair shall be an ex officio voting member of all subcommittees. 6. Notice of any full committee or subcommittee meeting shall specify whether the committee or subcommittee will conduct a hearing, work session, or both. Testimony shall be taken at a hearing but need not be taken at a work session. 7. All committee and subcommittee meetings shall be open to the public and press. 8. The chair may set a time limit on public testimony for the purpose of accommodating the greatest number of witnesses. 9. Any member of the full committee may attend and participate in any hearing or work session of a subcommittee to which he or she is not assigned. Such attendance shall not be considered in determining the presence of a quorum, and such participation shall not include voting on any issue before the subcommittee. 10. The affirmative vote of a majority of the appointed members is required, A, to cause a measure to be introduced by the committee, B, to table a measure, C, to remove a measure from the table, D, to amend a measure, E, to send a measure to the floor of the committee, F, to approve recommendations. 11. A motion in committee does not require a second. 12. Upon the request of two members, a roll call vote shall be taken and recorded on any question. 13. The notice of intent to file a minority report may only be applied to a measure reported out of committee. The minority report shall be subscribed to by at least two committee members who are present and vote in opposition to the committee report. They shall notify the chair or committee staff by 5 p.m. of the session day on which final action on the measure was taken, or before adjournment of the committee meeting during which such final action was taken, if adjournment is later than 5 p.m. Any members giving such notice shall have 48 hours after giving notice or until 5 p.m. of the second following session day, whichever is earlier, to deliver the minority report, including a legislative council draft, to the committee staff. Minority reports shall be filed at the desk on the same day the committee report is filed. No member shall sign on more than one minority report on the same measure. 14. Proposed amendments by other than members of the Legislative Assembly must be submitted in writing to committee staff at least 48 hours prior to the work session at which they are to be considered. And 15, the committee shall not report a measure to the floor of the House unless the written legislative council amendments accompanying the report have been approved by a majority of the members of the committee at a meeting called for that purpose. In addition, the committee shall review any fiscal or revenue impact statement issued in compliance with House Rule 8.20. Any correction or deletion, correction of clerical errors on amendments need not be approved by a majority of members, but shall be signed for by the committee chair. The corrected amendments must bear the written caption corrected. That's correct. Mr. Chair, on rule number 13, I believe for the record that it should read as follows. The notice of intent to file a minority report may only be applied to a measure reported out of committee. The minority report shall be subscribed to you by at least two committee members who are present and vote in opposition to the committee report. They shall notify the chair or committee staff by 5 p.m. of the business day on which final action on the measure was taken or before adjournment of the committee meeting during which such final action was taken if adjournment is later than 5 p.m. Any members giving such notice shall have 48 hours after giving notice or until 5 p.m. of the second following business day, whichever is earlier, to deliver the minority report, including a legislative council draft to the committee staff. Minority reports shall be filed at the desk on the same day the committee report is filed. No member shall file on more than one minority report on the same measure.
Mr. Chair, two questions.
Yes, Representative Dahlem.
Rule 13, that is lifted directly from present committee rules, isn't it?
I believe so.
Yeah, this is the way we have always operated.
Yeah.
And then on Rule 14, it says proposed amendments by other members of the Legislative Assembly must be submitted in writing. After the amendment is submitted, how soon will these committee members have the amendment within the 48 hours from when it's submitted and when we address it? When will we get an opportunity to look at it?
Do you have any idea about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, I don't know the answer to that, but I can certainly find out by the end of this at the end of this meeting or sooner if you'd like.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm certain it won't hold up approval of the rules. It's more an information. When
sure.
Can I expect it?
Sure. Thank you, Representative Dahlem. That's something that we should all be aware of. Representative Barnhart, I think you wanted to underscore a Scribner's error here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had this conversation about Rule 13 at an earlier training session. And in the rule was written with the word session appearing twice in it when the legislature actually was meeting every business day or nearly every business day. Now that the House is only meeting twice a week, at least during the first part of the term, changing that term to business day, which is defined in the House rules, is important because otherwise you could end up with a situation where the minority report isn't actually due for a week.
Correct. And
in effect, Mr. Chair, what this does is maintain the current practice.
Yes.
By changing that term.
Yes. Thank you. And as Administrator Osnak pointed out, she read it properly. Are there any other noted changes with reference to the changes to the Scribner's script? Do we have any proposed amendments, modifications, deletions, etc.? With that, Representative Riley, Is there a motion?
There is, Mr. Chair. I move that we adopt the rules as read for this committee.
Representative Riley moves adoption of the rules as read. Are there any objections? Hearing none, seeing none, the committee has adopted the rules. Thank you very much. Now I'd like to briefly describe the committee's introductory phase over the next couple of weeks. We're going to begin on Wednesday the 17th. Monday is recognition of Martin Luther King Day, so we will not be meeting. We will have five meetings, Wednesday the 17th through Friday, January 26th. We will be focusing on a set of best practices from invited guests for invited testimony, which will hopefully, in Representative Lim's words, help us to design the future. And Representative Lim feels very strongly that the future will happen. It's up to us to design what happens. And with a positive outcome from this committee, that's what we intend to do. We will begin by having a number of state agencies come in and talk to us about the current point of affairs in our state of our economy, where our workforce is at, what the potential is out into the future for workforce development, what are some of the developing clusters in our state, how we can address the needs of perhaps our traditional economy, as well as the new economy, as well as on out into our prospective economy into the future. That will be followed by, on Friday the 19th, a set of folks who are, many of whom are coming long distances from Washington, D.C. in particular, business labor, and the National Workforce Alliance to describe a set of national best practices to us, and perhaps to make some suggestions of some things that we ought to be thinking about doing here in Oregon. Then on Monday the 22nd and Wednesday the 24th, we're going to have the Oregon perspective on that. Again, similar folks coming before us, as well as a series of partnerships. We have specifically invited the Manufacturing 21 Group, as well as the Oregon Workforce Partnership, also the Oregon Center for Public Policy, some private sector economists, some of our largest international trading partners, as well as representatives of some of our state's largest industries to tell us what we're doing well, what we could do better, and perhaps some things that we might want to think about in terms of economic and workforce development and a whole set of potentially new clusters in our state. And we will finish up then on Friday the 26th talking about three clusters, representative of Oregon's traditional economy. Will be folks from the forest products industry. Representative of our new economy will be folks from various high-tech industries in our state. And lastly, a potential for future growth, we'll look at both the energy and healthcare sectors. So it's a rather ambitious agenda. We should have some very good information from some excellent presenters. And following that, hopefully that will give us or enable us to develop a kind of roadmap so that, as Representative Lim has suggested, our committee will be able to help design the future, and that will be a guidepost for us as to the kinds of legislation that we want to be hearing. Questions or comments from the committee on that? Everyone sound good to everyone? Great.
Pardon me.
Representative Dahl.
As I listen to the agenda, it sounds hearty. vibrant and robust. I did not hear specifically exports in there. Will we have...
Yes, Representative Dahlem. In fact, we are going to, on Monday the 22nd and Wednesday the 24th, we're going to be hearing from our state's largest international trading partners, and hopefully they will be telling us some of the things that we're doing very well in terms of marketing our exports, not only here in North America, but overseas, and perhaps some suggestions of things that we could do better. And I think that some of those suggestions might be cultural in nature, and things that may be fairly simple, and maybe we don't give enough thought about this, but it is very important oftentimes to our trading partners. So, anyone else? Okay, with that, the next thing that I would like to do is invite the public's comment on anything that you would like to make sure that our committee addresses, and recognizing that Salem may be a very long ways to travel for a lot of folks, and they would be unable to make a public hearing. For those of you who are listening to this hearing over the internet, our committee may be reached, and if you would like to make suggestions or comments to us, the House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development, Room 354, State Capitol in Salem, 97301. Again, that's the House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development, Room 354 at our State Capitol, Salem, 97301. Phone number is area code 503-986-1659, and we hope to be able to have here shortly, possibly an email. At this point, the committee does not have its very own email, but if we're able to secure one here, we'll make sure the public has that as well. And with that, by no means a formal hearing, but an opportunity for the public to make suggestions to us of items that they would like to see us cover here in our committee work. I'd like to make that opportunity available. Brian Craig has expressed an interest in doing that. Brian, would you come forward and please introduce yourself, who you are, and who you represent, or where you're from, or both, if that's appropriate?
Yes, Chairman Witt, members of the committee, I'm Brian Krieg, and today I'm here on the behalf of the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association and the Craftsmen of Sheet Metal Workers Local 16. We're very interested in the activities this committee will be engaged in, along with the committees dealing with education in this session, because workforce development and education are two things that come together in a very important way. One of the it being long-term issues for our contractors and then also the members of the Sheet Metal Union is workforce development, making sure that we have a skilled, qualified workforce in this state. One of the things that makes Oregon very attractive for companies to come in is the fact that we have construction building trades workers here who are at the top of their field in this whole entire country. They provide skilled work in such a way as they can provide value on the job site. We can actually build some of the high-tech plants and more complicated building projects in this state more efficiently than they can somewhere like Mississippi, where they may not pay the workers as much, but they can't perform in the same way. Education is key to that. Most of the building trades have a training center in this state. The contractors put a significant amount of money into that in developing the workforce. What our frustration has been is over the last decade or so, we have watched the education system in this state really walk away from promoting these jobs and career paths. These are careers and jobs that pay well. They have retirement benefits. They have health benefits. They have the education background in there and provide very, very good wages. In fact, you know, on average, many of the higher construction industry trades compete on an annual salary basis with a college graduate in the state. And so our concern is that in that the schools really have not been promoting this as a career path. We're having a struggle at this point finding apprentices who are of have an education level that they can actually perform. Electricians, plumbers, sheet metal workers who also are working in HVAC need to be able to have fairly high math skills. These are the same people that the colleges are competing for out there, but there's not the option really being presented about this career path out there. So we really encourage you to look at ways of maybe tying that together and helping for promotion in a more global way. I think most of us, when we were in school, all had shop classes or other opportunities to be exposed to different things. We didn't maybe go down those pathways, maybe we did, but at least we had the exposure, and I don't think the kids really are getting that now. And as you make changes, that would be our focus. All good jobs require education, but not all good jobs require a four-year degree.
Great.
And if you have any questions?
Questions, comments?
Mr. Chair. Pardon me, what is your name again?
It's Brian Krieg.
Brian. Where do you see in the educational process a separation, say grade 10, or do you see it as down the in the community colleges, or when you talked about shop classes, I had shop class when I was in high school, so you're seeing it more in the are you seeing it there?
High school is really probably one of the best target spots for this, though I think that in this day and age, the kids are learning so much more and seeing many different things much earlier than we used to actually exposing them to other types of careers at an earlier point, junior high, or somewhere where you can start talking about so they can start, you know, being interested and wondering why, oh, there's a large building going up here, what goes on with that? I think an exposure even earlier in a limited way would be useful, but definitely at the high school level. And whether it's that we're putting in shop classes or whether we're going back to focusing on some of differing ways of applied mathematics. Many times, there's a lot of students who have struggled with general textbook learning in a classical math class type of situation. Yeah, it's interesting if you take them out in the field, and we find this with a lot of teachers because we do take them out to our training centers. You start to show them how you create patterns for forming sheet metal projects and other things. You're using geometry and trigonometry, and it's in an applied way. And suddenly, it's teachers get exposed to that. Go, hey, wait, there's a great way. Maybe I can break down a barrier here in showing how you can actually use something. And the kids, when they get exposed to that, go like, oh, so that's why I needed to know that. And if a kid is kind of struggling, and they're the type of kid who they're very bright, but you just kind of know they're really not the type that's going to sit through 4 years of college and do that kind of thing. What are they going to do with their life? And if they don't see how they can apply some of these types of other opportunities, you know, are they going to stay in school? Or are they just going to drop out and go away? The average age of our apprentices coming in at the Sheet Metal Institute, 27 years old. What did they do for the last 9, 10 years? Were they putting money aside for their retirement because they had a good job that did that? Probably not. So look at the long-term implication. Were they, you know, getting good health care during that time and taking care of themselves? Probably not. And then also we look at it as a standpoint of, from the construction industry, you really have a certain kind of life expectancy of how long you can really work physically hard out in the trades on it. So if they come in at 27, do they have 30 years in front of them, or is it more like 20 where they have the ability to really do some of the hard work that is out there? Otherwise, they're going to have to find a little different position within the industry. So coming in that late, we've lost them for 10 years where I think we're really critical. And so trying to expose them is important early.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. This is really a follow-up question on that one, and that is, what and based on your answer, when would you like to get them? Would you like to get them at 16 or 15 or 18, or what are you talking about?
15 or 16 would be really good to be able to start talking to them, because it gives you enough time to keep them in school, keep them on some other options of saying, okay, I will hammer it through that math class, or there's an alternative type of math class that's offered out there that makes the equivalencies of what they need to get out of school, but maybe approaches it in a very different way.
Follow up on that?
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Should we be thinking about some kind of a pre-apprenticeship program for high school students?
I think that could be a very useful opportunity. And getting them to, once again, it goes back to learning some things about math, learning some things about just even how the economy works. I think there's a lot of practical types of skills, and then English language skills are important with that. Computer skills are getting more important, and even for regular guys out on the job site, quite often you're interacting with the computer, whether it's just putting in the materials that you're using that day, or whether it's downloading plans that you're going to be using on the site.
Representative Thome?
Yes, Brian, your concerns are shared by most of us. It seems to me that if we have a vocational program, every student should be involved. If they do not involve themselves in the vocational teasers that we present, it's the only time they'll ever see other jobs. If they do get involved, it gives them a leg up on those jobs. But I'm going to make you king of the world for a moment and draft some legislation for us to pass. Because when we get into education, we're on some slippery slopes. It's fraught with difficulty. But you're now king of the world. What are you going to ask us to do legislatively? What's our job? We come out of this committee with to improve our students' awareness of what's available, to give them perhaps a taste of it. What's our legislation going to be?
Well, I think you hit two of the most important points right there at the end. It is giving them the taste of it in the schools, bringing some of those classes back into the forefront, doing some things with the counselors, I think, to do different kinds of career exposure. Maybe they have to have one class that explores different types of careers that are out there, where they can start to see how the wages actually would impact them over time a little bit, have some exposure of what you could make in this type of field, and then tying that into, and what types of education skills do you need to get to, what are the benchmarks you need to shoot for to stay in school and at least get to another level. I would not advocate doing something quite as radical as they do in some of the European countries or Japan, where the kids, yes, they teach them really, really well, but they also pretty much sort them out, and your pathway is decided for you. You don't have a lot of choice. We still need to provide choice for the kids, but it is the exposure opportunity, and whether it would be some type of class early on that really explores what jobs do and what are the needs for it. I think that type of opportunity, and then bringing some of those classes back into the schools. Recently, at one of the schools in Portland, they were cleaning out a room that had been used for heavy storage down in their basement. A lot of stuff had just been stacked in it for years and years and years, and what they uncovered in there is, behind a whole lot of the stuff and underneath it, they had a full metal shop in there that had not been used in decades. We're hoping to go in and do some things with them to try and bring some classes back, and maybe borrow some students from a few of the other schools. But that's one of the types of things that we run into out there. I think for the industry, one of the key things is trying to tie this together so the students also can find some job information through the state, through their schools, in a lot easier method, where it's a lot easier to get exposure to groups, where it'd be easier to find internships or mini training classes or some type of exposure out there. Our industry is getting hit with a whole lot of little workforce task force groups. You mentioned a number of the larger ones that are out there. There's dozens and dozens of them, or groups that are trying to help us get to minority students, and that's a really challenging issue for us, has been getting minority apprentices into the trades. Part of the issue is the ones who stay in school have the education traditional background to become an apprentice, well, they're really heavily recruited by industry and the higher education community on that. So we kind of have a, it's hard to develop that pool. But there's so many groups trying to help us out there that we don't know which one to be involved with and which one to give some funding to and this kind of thing. It's just been balkanized because I think that we've stepped away from it, from what we kind of used to do a long time ago.
Thank you. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for your presentation. I have a little bit of knowledge of apprenticeship programs myself, and you know, and I recognize that problem. But my question, I guess, is more of a demographic question, and I'm aware, but not specifically, of the numbers of the overall construction industry, of the average age of our skilled workforce in the trades, for example, and the demographics going forward with those folks retiring. What percentage do you think right now currently exist in the construction industry of workers that are apprentices, or how much of the work is being currently being performed by apprentices? And to follow that up, what percentage do we really need to have to make sure that we have that skilled workforce for the future? Because I know that we've got a tremendous amount of construction work in this region over the next 15 years, and I hear a lot of contractors crying and calling out for more. They can't find the workers. They can't find the skilled workforce. And so I'm kind of wondering about those demographic numbers and, you know, what we need to do policy-wise to help address that shortage.
Chairman Witt, Representative Holvey, I don't have those numbers really off the top of my head here, and I know that if it'd be possible at some time, myself and I'm sure Bob Shiprack would love to be able to come back and present some good hard numbers for you on that. Estimating within the sheet metal industry, apprentices probably make up about 15% right at the moment, and this is part of our issue is that if you're looking at them at 15% and they're somewhere around 27 to 30 years old, and in the major range, they're already a little bit older, and so what's the rest of the age out there? We've got, it's the baby boomer bubble going through, and so we are looking at a significant amount of folks starting to retire out in the next 10 years, and it really does worry the contractors, particularly because they're looking back over to the union hall saying, where's the force here within the hall for us to get to? And then you're starting to, you know, then see all the trades starting to pick over the same handfuls of people coming along on it. But we'd love to come back with that if we can.
Thank you. Representative Gerard.
Chairman Witt. To follow up, Brian, on a couple more questions, it would seem to me like we have a real problem with the dropout rate in high school, and it would seem that that what you were proposing would, for a good many students, get them to graduate. Is there any places that have implemented any strategies like that you would be a proponent of, and how has that affected the dropout rate?
Chair Witt, Representative Gerard, I don't have a great example of that where it tracks back to looking at the dropout rate on it. It just there may be some studies on that that we could find. I do think that if you provide hope for someone that, okay, if you're not going to go on to college, that there's a lot of other opportunities, it does give them a reason to actually stay there. If it's going to be that I go to college and I can't do that, or I don't want to do that, it's just not me, and flipping burgers or some other kind of service type of job, that's not a big incentive to stay there, especially if you maybe have the opportunity to go get a job or do something at that age.
Thank you. That's funny. I like that.
Very good. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Brian, I want to thank you ever so much. I recognize that your presentation here was very impromptu, I believe.
It was, thank you.
And you've elicited, I think, just a great line of discussion here. Your comments, I think, are fodder for us following up as a committee on a number of different things. I wanted to comment before you leave on the problem that's facing what apparently a number of industries. I hear you talking about, you know, your members retiring out in probably a decade. I'm hearing the same thing from employers in the manufacturing industry.
Railroad.
And it has the appearance that we're running into a potential crisis situation here, potentially a decade or a little more out in terms of our actually having not only a workforce that is adequately trained, but simply sheer numbers as well. So we have the dual problem.
Chair Witt, I think I've heard this from other industries also, and this is going to be a problem for Oregon to maintain its competitiveness. I think the governor made a great statement at the leadership summit in Portland last week when he stated that we need more engineers, but we also need more electricians. So,
not true. Not true. President Bell,
anything else? Do we have right now, if we could bring you the people we need through incentive or high school offerings or whatever the case, do we have the capacity to teach them that sheet metal trade right now?
Absolutely. Portland in particular is our main training center. It's just off of Interstate 84 and 178th Street. Very nice institute. We have the classrooms and the equipment there to do it. We could go to expanded classroom times. We've done some, we used to do the trades and it was much in the evenings, most of our training. A lot of that has really shifted now to more concentrated training blocks where we bring in the apprentices for a week at a time, have them up in a motel across the, you know, that are nearby the center there, and focus them on that. But we can, the training center has the capacity that we could be running classes more frequently out there, and we have the physical equipment. We also have a facility down in the Eugene area. I think most of all the building trades, in particular the larger trades, all have the capacity to ramp up and have more people in their system.
So the bottleneck is people, and people in a timely fashion.
Yes. I mean, if you dropped in tens of thousands on those tomorrow, that would be a little bit of a problem. And okay, where do we use them on the job site? Also, there. I mean, there is a little chicken and egg there. We need to have the work to make sure we can continue to have the apprentices, and we're paying for them. And I think that's one of the great things too about apprentices in the building trades is while they're learning, and in the case of the unions, their training is being paid for by their employers. They're also earning a good wage.
Anyone else? Brian, thank you so very, very much. Appreciate your comments.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You bet. And look forward to hearing from you throughout the session. Counties have anything to add to our discussion this morning? Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Doris Penwell, and I represent the Association of Oregon Counties, which is all of the 36 Oregon counties. Speaking of impromptu, I appreciate the opportunity to just remind you in the program that you have before you for the session, I would like to remind you that throughout Oregon, businesses work with community leaders, whether they are volunteers or elected officials, and they work closely with each other in making sure that the community does the job that they need to keep businesses in their communities. And no matter what the subject is that you have coming before you, counties, cities, individuals from those areas are very interested in what you're doing, and we will probably have comments and some ideas about how we can be sure that the state and local officials stay working together in a partnership rather than separating out the state from the locals, and in terms of funding, in terms of making sure the programs work right, because many of these people at the local level work on state programs representing their communities. So I just want to remind you that that also works in regard to all of these major industrial representatives, and we'll have a lot of perspective on that.
Questions or comments for Ms. Pennell?
Yes, Dorothy, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to comment on the economic impact of the loss of federal forest money to our counties. Those counties that counted on that money, and I'm going to watch Dorothy, she starts shaking her head no, she's going to take over and make this right.
No.
But we have at least a double threat in the counties that I represent. One is economic development, and the other is a huge loss in county revenue. Mm-hmm. So that the means to do the training, to bring the workforce to the field, is going to be heavily impacted if we don't find a solution to the county tax problem.
Yes, Representative Witt and Representative Dallum. Of course, we have a serious problem, and unfortunately, not just at the county level, but at the state level and the federal level, we haven't gotten on top of this as nearly as quickly as we probably should have. We were so hopeful that this whole county payments program would continue, and, you know, I have to tell you, people from all over the state have worked very hard on that, and we still hope that in the short term, at least, we will have some relief from what really is a disaster in some of our counties. The biggest disaster is in the southwest section of the state, where so much of their property is taken up in federal forest and forest lands. And I don't have to tell you what the issue is, except to say that last Monday, the counties got together in their legislative committee with representatives from most of the state, and we just went around the room and talked about what the impact is from loss of these monies to their discretionary funding that runs every program at the local level. Both the loss of the funding and what do you do about it at the local level, as well as what do you do about it at the state level. I have to say that the loss of money doesn't just affect the counties. It affects the state, too, and some of their programs. Road funding and education, a big chunk of money is coming out of education because of this loss. And at the local level, a lot of the discretionary funding that is used for programs like community corrections, you know, will be public safety is really in jeopardy because of the loss of this money. So the counties are not trying to just say, you have to solve this for us. We have put together a group of individuals to come up with a package of things that we might consider doing together in a partnership to take care of our own future, frankly. And I think I know the revenue committees in the Senate and the House are entertaining some of this discussion. I know that if you're interested in some of that discussion at this table, we'll certainly be able to come and talk to you about that as well, because it does affect what you're able to do actually at the local level. And, you know, sometimes when you talk about discretionary funding at the local level that's available for things like economic development, you have to take care of first things first, and sometimes the money moves from what you're used to spending it on to something that you have to spend it on if we're in such a loss. So we're really here to respond and help you develop a strategy that will work for us.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing that subject matter up. I know it's a huge issue for my county as well. Lane County is projected to lose perhaps $20 million if this out of their budget, and that's a huge hit for them. Or unknowing how we would manage that, and if the state were to have to put into their budget to help backfill some of the services that are required to be provided, it would have a pretty large impact on our budget. So I'm glad that the revenue is looking at this issue. It is very disturbing. But you, can you give us sort of an update on where we're at with that at the federal level? Or have the is the federal government stepping in to postpone this, or at least provide some of the funding going forward, or is it looking like we are just losing it all?
Chair Witt and Representative Holvey, day to day it changes, but frankly, with a change in leadership at the national level, it's almost like you're starting over. There's a lot of discussion about what we can still do, and our congressional delegation is working very hard to see if we can get this on the radar screen to come in and at least for a one-year period try to help us out with funding. But there is even discussion about changing the formula that we've been living under so that some of the funding that you might even have in a one-year level would be reduced for Oregon because it would be moved to some other states. We're a small state. We probably don't have the clout that we'd love to have at the national level. And so it's very difficult to get the attention we need to get them to understand what the crisis is for us. Frankly, it's hard to get people in Oregon to understand the crisis we've got. If you're in a county that doesn't rely on the amount of funding that, say, Lane County relies on, you don't really see what the issue is because you sort of hone in on what your own issues are. And frankly, some of the areas that aren't reduced in funding around the state, in this meeting we had last Monday that I talked about, it was sort of an eye-opener to them. Even though they knew about it, they didn't really relate to what it meant in terms of reducing funding. The state and counties have a partnership, a system of serving the same constituents. And when the state gives the county money to run a program like mental health, public health, community corrections, da-da-da, they frequently take some of their discretionary funding from property taxes or from some other source and adds it to the pot that's used for those programs. If they do not have the funding, they may have to give the program back to the state. That means it's a problem for the state. So that's why this is an issue that we have to solve together. And frankly, at the federal level, we're trying, and people are going back to Washington this month again to see what they can do to get them to understand that this is important, at least in the short term, to kind of get us over a hump until we can do something about our own destiny. Anyway, we'll have a lot more to say about it, and we could have a prepared presentation for you if you'd like.
I would really like to, in deference to the charge that this committee has, I would like a presentation, and I would like to know what this impact will be on economic development, at least as our county partners are concerned, because I think it's going to be traumatic. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us are going to have to be in the boat to solve this. Cities, counties, state, mayhaps even the federal, some, but we're not going to solve it from the state level or from the county level. We're going to do it together. And so I'd like to know the economic impact.
Sure, of course. And could I just say one other thing?
Please.
There are a lot of people that think we might just be able to tax our way out of this problem, but the problem is that the Constitution won't allow us to do that, and frankly, there aren't enough people in a county that could come up with enough tax money to pay for a program. You know, if your county is 75% federal property, you don't have very many people paying taxes on their property, therefore you can't possibly do it yourself. So that's why it's a problem we all have to deal with and try to figure out what do we need to change at the state level to make things, at least fair for all of us. And we'd be very glad to come back and talk about the impact on economic development.
Representative Dahlem, it is going to be a traumatic. Doris, we'd love to have a presentation on that. Excuse me. And I think that Representative Girard had a comment or question here.
I just had a quick question. I come from a timber district, so
yes,
obviously we're impacted too.
Sure.
And there was some of the smaller meetings that I attended, some talk about perhaps bringing
state forest timber receipts as a backfill measure. Have you heard or given that any consideration?
I've heard a lot of discussion about some of the things we might do, Representative Girard, but I think it'd be best if I had somebody come and give you sort of a better discussion about what the ramifications are and what the pros and cons are. And there is a proposal out there that is being thought about to make sure that our timberlands, state timberlands, and are productive for economic development purposes. So, so yes, we could come back, but I don't think I'm the one that should present that to you. There are other people that have worked on this long and hard, and I'd like you to hear it from them, if I could.
Thank you very much.
Representative Girard, and when we have the cluster discussion about the forest products industry, we're going to have folks in, not only from the industry, but from the Department of Forestry as well.
Thank you very much.
So that may help there. Just to kind of, I think, maybe ground us a little bit, in order to understand the magnitude of the trauma that, that potentially awaits us, Oregon's economy is still dependent to a large extent on our on many of our traditional industries. And the extent to which we were dependent on forest products makes our payments here in the state of Oregon larger than all of the other states combined. Representative Dahlin was right on the mark when he said that the traumas people don't recognize. I think Doris, as you pointed out, how large a hit this is going to be to our state. So all of us will throw a little holy water your way and send you on and do good works and bail us all out of this situation, will you, please?
Nice.
any other questions or comments from the committee? Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Really. And having discussed the forest products industry, is there any comments that you'd like to make before the committee, Mr. Cluding? Welcome. Please introduce yourself to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Witt. For the record, my name is Bill Cluding. I represent the Carpenters Industrial Council, representing 33,000 members across the United States. I handle the legislative affairs here in Oregon. Very interesting conversations we've had this morning. This little piece of paper, I've carried this. I've mailed out hundreds of these. This came out in the Oregonian in February 2005. And the total for the counties that they are going to lose is $273 million. The bill was drafted. This came out of Senator Wyden's office. It was he was one of the main draftees of this bill in 2000. And last session, I cautioned the lawmakers in both houses that this might not be here in 2007. I always emphasize, I hope it is, but I says, I don't think it's, I think it's going to go away. Oregon is in a position where we can't look back. We have to look forward. We have to have a vision. We can't bring the timber industry back to where we were in the 80s. We all know that. We're fighting to maintain the mills we have now. We're losing mills right now. My vision for the forest in this state, I've been last session, Senate Bill 1072 from Senator Nelson's office was passed by both houses and the governor. Biomass cogeneration. I've also been appointed to be on the Federal Forest Advisory Committee by our congressional leaders. There's 12 of us on this board. We just started a round of meetings on that. Our biomass meetings have we've finished. The final draft will be, you'll have your hands on that final draft this month. And I see there is a future for our federal forests. The The hard part is getting the federal forest folks to partner up with us. I hope to bring a gentleman in at the end of the month that has a cogeneration plant in the White City Medford area. If not, we will have a written summary for you. But this is where we can move forward. We can do two things. We can create jobs, of course, and we want to create good quality family wage jobs. But also, we can start restoring the health of our 21 million acres in Oregon that are in dire need. Category 3, Category 2 fire. We lost 500,000 acres to fire last year. And the point was well taken that every county in this state is affected by this. I urge this committee, and I will personally hand them out, every representative and every senator in this House needs to have this hanging on their wall.
Bill, for the record, would you please read the title of that article?
Lawmakers introduced bill to continue timber payments.
And that was, do you have a date on that?
In the Oregonian, February the 4th, 05.
Thank you.
And I will furnish you a copy. But I urge this committee to make sure that all your fellow representatives and senators have this. It should be on their wall, right behind their desk, because this could hamstring this state. If these counties don't get these monies, the state budget will be in shambles, because the counties have to function also. Cogeneration, biomass. Again, I've narrowed my field just about to this issue. I will be talking with all of you, anybody and everybody, but I see in this state sites for 10 to 12 of these plants. It's expensive, but Congress did do one thing before they adjourned this year. They did pass the energy bill, and there is all of our federal grants that makes these cogeneration plants possible. And I'm gathering data on this, and I'll keep you well informed. But my vision is that we can put 1,000 people to work back in our federal force with partners with the federal force in 15 to 20 year contracts, and that's what it's going to take to clean up our forests. I'll answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions or comments from the committee? Representative Gerard.
I really like what you have to say about cogeneration biomass, but you also brought up the problem that we have in our forests with fire. Could you kind of elaborate on that just a little bit as to what you see that maybe from a policy statement we could do from the state level to alleviate some of the problems that we have had with fire, because I personally think a lot of it is preventable.
I am gathering the data together to put in a folder to present to each one of you, and I will also be doing this on the Senate side, how many acres that are in Category 3, how many acres are in, which is the extreme. That's the extreme. Category 2 is bad. Mm-hmm. The Category 3 is a tinderbox waiting to happen. This biomass removal, if it's done correctly, environmentally sound, we can have the lightning strikes. We can have the accidental fires, but you'll be able to send a small crew and one pickup in there and put that little fire out. The way it is now, one lightning strike, and that's another thing our committees are working on, is a bureaucracy between U.S. Forest Service and BLM and our state forest laws on how to fight these fires. That's one of our policies that we are working on. Long range, we have millions of acres that need to be treated for fire.
Mr. Kluding, for the benefit of the folks that may be listening on the Internet, could you clarify for us, is that all forests in Oregon, or are there particular forests that are prone to these catastrophic fires?
Chair Witt, our Oregon State Forests are in very good condition. The majority of them, our main forests in the private industry, are in very good condition, well taken care of. But Oregon is a very unique state. The federal timberlands are intermixed with all of our other forests. If you ever have a map out, and you can get cross-eyed trying to follow where all these different forests are, but our federal forest is the main problem. And this is what we're concentrating on, and on these committees is letting the federal forest officials relinquish some of the duties and turn it over to our Oregon State Forestry Department and help them come up with a plan to clean these forests up.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Kluding. It is something that we recognize. But in speaking of biomass, and you mentioned the cogeneration, I believe the Oregon Forest Resources Institute is also exploring using the cellulosic biomass to convert it to ethanol and biodiesel as potentially being a very good use of biomass as well. Do you have any information about that? And you know, just thinking about what the state can do in this area to, I guess, in the terms of economic development, is fostering those new industries.
Yes, Representative Holby, thank you for the question. There is documentation out there, and by the time this committee is wrapping things up, we will have all that information for you. There is a market for that, yes. The main market, I feel, for the biomass coming out of the federal forest will produce electricity. Yes, it is. It's more expensive what hydroelectric is, but California has obligated themselves to buy our green electricity. Generate steam. We, in our rural school areas, we could convert our school buildings, our county buildings, back to steam fed from these cogeneration plants instead of buying oil or gas. There's many, many uses for, and also in the process of removing biomass, we're talking thinning of the overgrown stock, which will help provide material for the mills that are in the areas. Right now I have three mills in eastern Oregon that have not enough logs to run through the winter. They don't know what they're going to do. But we will have that information for you, Representative.
Representative
Dolan. I want a clarification, and if I may, a follow-on right after that, Mr. Chairman. When you talk about state forests being fairly clean, and you're including the Elliott and the Tillamook, they do not present the biomass problems that the federal forests do?
Representative Dolan, there is a now, we had some blowdown occur in that Tillamook district, Representative Witt. I think it's most of it's in your area. I talked to the chief forester, Marvin Brown, and he figures they might be about 5 million feet on the ground now. But there's already plans in effect to remove that downed timber. I'd like to be able to take you on some of the tours I go on, and even just elk hunting. A good example would be over behind Lincoln City. you can be driving along, it's a paved road going up into the upper headwaters of Drift Creek, but there you go through state and then you go through BLM. And you're going through the state forest and you can see through the forest, the trees are there, the trees are healthy, the ground has the proper amount of biomass on the floor to create a healthy forest. And then you can come to a boundary and that you're, it says entering BLM.
In my district,
you can see the results of a lack of good forest health care.
In my district, several times the fire has originated in the federal forest, burned out onto state and private land, and the raging debate is who pays for this. The answer seems clear to me, but not so to everybody.
Thanks.
Yeah. Representative Dolan, did you have any follow-up?
No, thank you very much.
Okay. Anyone else? Mr. Cluding, just I wanted to ask you what the opportunity is. I know you mentioned job creation in terms of biomass and silvicultural applications in our various forests. Can you talk about the length of employment that one might be able to develop in terms of these kinds of jobs? Are we talking about year-round jobs? Are these seasonal jobs? That sort of thing.
Excuse me. Are they 10 years, 5 years,
yeah.
2 years?
Yes, that's a good question, Representative Wett. The federal government's having trouble looking at a 15 to 20-year contract. The way these cogeneration plants would work, you would pick a spot in this state, and we have about 12 sites that really need this right now. You set your cogeneration plant up; it's available to send the power out. You take a radius of like 50 to 70 miles, and by the time you complete that 360-degree circle, you're looking at 15 years. You might not even have to move. These are portable plants. You might not even have to move it. You might be able to stay in that one spot. But we're looking at 15 years to cover that 360 degrees.
And Mr. Cluding, over the course of the 15 years, are we talking about full-time year-round jobs?
Yes. In extreme winter, extreme snow, that limits what you can do out in the forest, but you have your fuel set aside, stored. I would say 70% of that workforce would continue to work year-round. Your power generation is 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. There's one place where we need some trained, skilled boiler technicians. Each one of these units, when you convert biomass, there's a boiler involved. And hopefully the gentleman from Medford, when he comes up, he'll be able to dwell on that. They do have training down there for boiler tenders. Right in this area, we don't have any right now, but I feel we're going to need them. And I beseech this committee to keep this open mind on this, and also the new equipment that they'll be using in these federal forests to remove the biomass is not the ordinary, the old bulldozer type. They're land friendly, they don't abuse the land, and we're going to have people ready to hit the ground, already trained, to make this thing work.
Representative Dolan.
Is having a co-generating plant in Prairie City and one that we're struggling to find fuel for on the Warm Springs Reservation, I'm very interested. But I want the list of things to do. The sooner we can put biomass, Prairie City's struggling to get material and a market. That power costs a little bit more. But if you gave us a thing to-do list, I would be interested not in doing them, but in running and doing them. So I want very much to know, because we do have a complicated relationship. Most of the cleanup you're talking about is on federal forest, which puts us at a vicarious position to help. But if we can help, I certainly want to. This sort of cleaning activity of federal forest in my district would provide all the things you've talked about: jobs, security, income, hope, excitement. So give me the list.
Thank you, Representative Ellen. I will have all this put together to present to you.
I would just like to make one point that I can run faster than this Representative Dallum, so I will be helping you as well.
You can't water slide as fast as I can.
Ooh, that is a scary sight.
Mr. Kooling, thank you so very, very much. I want to assure you, and I think it's obvious, that you've captured the attention here of this committee. And as you look up and down the dais here, you're looking at timber-dependent districts. And by and large, you're looking at rural Oregon. And in rural Oregon, 1,000 jobs means a big difference. We will take the onesies and twosies, and we will take the onesies and twosies that pay family wage jobs every day of the week. And to the extent that you're onto something here that may take a traditional industry and provide some hope and future for folks who have lost their jobs in communities where employment is exceedingly hard to come by, then we want to hear all about what you have to propose to this committee. And thank you ever so much for your impromptu presentation. And we will look forward to getting more details from you at a later time.
Thank you. And again, I will hand deliver, if I can get the hands on the copies, I will hand deliver these to every rep and state senator. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else left in the audience that would like to make a public comment? Not seeing or hearing from anyone. Again, just a reminder to the public that our committee may be reached at House Committee on Economic and Workforce Development, Room 354, State Capitol, Salem, Oregon, 97301. Our phone number is area code 503-986-1659. There are over 3.5 million citizens that live in the state of Oregon, and there are a lot of very good ideas that a number of you have out there. Our committee would love to hear that. Thank you all very, very much, and thank the committee for their attentiveness and a great discussion. I'm looking forward to this committee. We're going to do some good things. With that, our committee stands adjourned. Thank you.